Welcome to another episode of ACS Law Talk. I'm Joseph Jerome, a law fellow here at the American Constitution Society, and today we feature a conversation with law professor Garrett Epps. It focuses on his new book, Wrong and Dangerous, 10 Right-Wing Myths About Our Constitution. Professor Epps is a law professor at the University of Baltimore Law School, where he teaches constitutional law. He's published many, many books and lots of articles for general audiences in the field of both constitutional law and civil rights. Wrong and Dangerous is a critique of the toxic coalition of talking heads, radio hosts, and angry at patriot groups that are wiping out historical fact and substituting partisan myth. Professor Epps begins his talk by explaining his motivations for the book and why he decided to write it.
I got curious. I began to read about patriot groups, and as you say, I live on Capitol Hill, and I saw people going by with the Constitution. And I got curious about where this was coming from, so I signed up for Constitution schools, sponsored by the National Center for Constitutional Studies from the hamlet of Malta, Idaho, which sends instructors all over the country every weekend to teach citizens the substance and meaning of the Constitution. That's their phrase. And I spent the longest day of my life in the basement of a Lutheran church out past Vienna, Virginia, working with, we had little workbooks and fill in the blanks. And I thought I was going to hear a fairly far-right version of the Constitution, but I was not prepared for what I heard, which was basically, and I'm not exaggerating this, God wrote the Constitution. He handed it down to Moses. Moses used the Constitution to rule the children of Israel in the desert. After the captivity, the 10 lost tribes made their way to England and became the Anglo-Saxons in the 5th century and ruled England according to God's law. The Normans ruined that whole thing. And so the founding fathers revived it. And the purpose of the Constitution is to restore us to the 5th century Anglo-Saxon kingdom. And this is presented without a shred of irony, and the Tea Party activists around me are writing it down and believing it. And I did, on my way out, I saw that somebody had brought their 12-year-old son to this, and I thought that's kind of touching, because the kid obviously was kind of bored, and he had spent his time drawing. And I looked over his shoulder to see what he had drawn, It was at the top of the page were the words preserve, protect, and defend, and then a startlingly accurate drawing of an assault rifle. So the atmosphere is fairly toxic, and the claims that are being made for the Constitution on the right are so much more extreme than we are prepared to believe, and the degree of success that people are having with these ideas is more than we would like to think.
Professor Epps went on to explain why he thinks the right is so much more successful in framing discussions about constitutional rhetoric than progressives are.
The progressive side of things doesn't want to constitutionalize our issues. We want self-government to be allowed to work. No one looks at the Constitution and says, oh, here in the Due Process Clause is our entitlement to an individual mandate and comprehensive health insurance. We believe that is for the political branches to design. That's a more nuanced position. I think it is very important to the right to constitutionalize their issues, because as democratic issues, they're losers, right? Government can't protect the environment. That one's not going to survive an up and down vote. Government can't protect workers' rights. Again, that's not going to survive an up and down vote. So it's much more important to them to get this into the courts, to get people believing the Constitution forbids the United States from having a modern government. Than it is for our side, because we think correctly the Constitution already allows us to govern ourselves.
Wrong and Dangerous, therefore, became something of a project to provide a toolbox of arguments to a broad audience.
You'll see that I have made a real attempt to pitch this at the reader who is not a lawyer, not an academic, maybe not someone even who works in public policy in Washington, but is at home, you know, literate, interested, listening to the radio and hearing people say healthcare is unconstitutional because the Constitution doesn't mention healthcare, and thinks, you know, is that really right? As soon as these claims get made, they create a sense in people's minds. Is that really right? The book is designed for that person. And for a lot of progressive intellectuals, there's not much payoff in writing for the ordinary person.
Professor Epps then took on explaining his first myth, that is, that some people believe only in original intent, while others believe in the so-called living constitution. Professor Epps decided to elaborate on what exactly he understands originalism to be.
There are these varieties of originalism. There's Da Vinci Code originalism, which says, no, the Constitution doesn't really mean that, you know, when it says those words. It's really a reference to something else that I found in a book, you know, I found in Hale's Pleas of the Crown or something else. Don't pay attention to the words. There's pay no attention to that man behind the curtain originalism, in which you say, but Madison said this about the separation of church and state. And the answer, and Justice Thomas has written this in the U.S. reports, oh, we have Madison doesn't count, he was an extremist. So when you have a founding father who doesn't support your position, you say, well, you know, he really wasn't one of them. There's everybody knows originalism, which you say, well, yes, that's right, the Constitution doesn't say you can't have health care, but everyone knows that that's what the framers were thinking, and therefore it counts. And then finally, there's voices in the head originalism, and Justice Scalia will say this. He says it in Citizens United. He says, yes, Justice Stevens, you've quoted a lot of the founding fathers saying they didn't trust corporations, but trust me, I knew the founding fathers, I worked with the founding fathers. The founding fathers were friends of mine. I talked to them just last night, and they said modern corporations are different, and they do support allowing them unlimited free speech rights. These are phony moves, and we have every right in the world to expose them and say, if you want to follow the original intent, the original understanding of the Constitution, there's one thing we know the framers intended, the ratifiers understood, and that is the words on the page. Keep your attention on those. We can win that battle.
Professor Epps then explained that the more he read the text of the Constitution, the more he came to believe that it was very much a progressive document.
Honestly, I'd get up in the morning and I'd say, today, you know, I'm going to look at Article 1, Section 10, I'm going to read it over and over. You begin to see more and more in it. And, you know, by the time I was getting to the 14th Amendment, I had had this breakthrough, which was, you know, cut off my legs and call me shorty. This document is on our side. It's not a reactionary limits on government, you know, prevent people, state-oriented. It is, in fact, Madison's vision of the nationalist Madison before he became the states' rights Madison, who later became the nationalist Madison again. The nationalist Madison's vision of a self-governing republic with a government with adequate authority to do what it needs. That's our vision. So the first thing, you know, I would say to that is that we win. You know, we win these arguments. The arguments are there to be won. And, you know, we might as well make them. Especially since they have, as Kissinger used to say, the added advantage of being true.
So what then is all of this talk about the so-called living constitution? Professor Epps has an explanation.
Here is the trap not to fall into. And I think this is why people, if you separate these two things, people are correct to be a little suspicious. You don't fall into the trap of saying, of being the Clarence Thomas of the left and saying, everything that has happened since the first Supreme Court was installed is illegitimate, and we have to go back to my vision of the text. We have a system of stare decisis in this country, and the Supreme Court over the years has produced, you know, very useful bodies of precedent, which the originalist project on the right, to a large extent, is designed to destabilize and do away with. And we see now, as the project of the Roberts Court, I think, a kind of slash and burn assault on stare decisis. And so whatever we do has to be framed also around that. It's not simply, this is the way it's portrayed, you know, that Bill Brennan would wake up in the morning and have oatmeal and say, I know, I'll go write pornography into the Constitution today. What a delightful idea. The living Constitution has to do with following precedent, applying precedent as well as text, as well as history.
After some more discussion, Professor Epps turned to his second myth, that is that our founders wrote our Constitution in order to restrain Congress and to sharply limit the powers of the national government.
This is where text is really very powerful. Historically, you know, Ron Paul says the framers wrote the Constitution for one purpose alone, to restrain Congress. That idea is, you know, nuts. The main thing that brought the framers to Philadelphia was this terror that Congress was too weak there was barely any federal government to restrain. When Washington went from head of Mount Vernon to president, he ended up with fewer people working for him as president than he had as head of Mount Vernon. That's how small the federal government was. And so the purpose of the Constitution was to create an adequate government. And I think if you read the text, if you see the number of... Read Article 1, Section 8. It really is a kind of love poem to congressional power. It's lyrical. I mean, believe it. Put your preconceptions aside and read it, and you see a picture of a country that these people imagined with an adequate government. And so I think that's the way we go with that.
Professor Epps also explained that contrary to Tea Party talking points, subsequent amendments to the federal Constitution actually endorse a vision of broad national power.
I mean, I do think it's important to notice that with the exception of the 21st Amendment, which, thank God, there is no amendment, there is no single amendment to the Constitution that restricts federal power further. Every amendment that guarantees individual rights also carries with it language empowering the Congress further to encroach on the states and protect those individual rights. So since the framing of a nationalist document, we have repeatedly made it more national. I got a letter from someone saying, you liberals, you always talk about congressional power. If you think Congress should be powerful, why don't you amend the Constitution? And I wrote back and I said, actually we have. So Amendments 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 19, 24, 26. And he wrote back and says, yeah, but except for those.
Professor Epps' third myth addresses the suggestion that Congress has somehow distorted the meaning of the commerce power in order to pass clearly unconstitutional laws. His response.
When I grew up in the South, and I was 14 years old when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed, and I remember, my local paper said, this is a day of mourning. The Constitution is dead. And the argument at that time was, can Congress use the commerce power to regulate, non-commercial conduct, like, who you served and so forth. Now, I think the conduct was, frankly, commercial, but that's a different question. The idea was they're leaping the firewall by aiming at non-commercial ends. By the time we get to 2012, the argument has become Congress can't use the commerce power to regulate the insurance market. In other words, the commerce power can't reach commerce. And I think that is a very radical turn. And it's very important to note that while we talk about combating these crackpot ideas that are out on the radio, these ideas are infiltrating the federal judiciary. I saw a moment in the healthcare arguments that I found absolutely breathtaking. Michael Carvin, representing the National Federation of Independent Business, was arguing in front of the court about the limits the framers intended on the commerce power. And Justice Breyer, said to him, Mr. Carvin, let's suppose that there was an epidemic, and it was going to kill 40% of the population, but we didn't know which 40%. Could Congress require vaccination? Without blinking, Carvin said, no, they could not. That's a mere prophecy of future events. It's purely a local matter. What's stunning is that he felt it was okay to make that argument in front of 9 very smart lawyers, very powerful lawyers. He felt safe to make an argument that extreme. Whereas if anyone tried to make something that far from the norm on the left side, there would be nothing left of them but a smoking pair of shoes at that lectern.
Myth 4, the Constitution does not provide for a separation between church and state.
I believe that at the time of the framing, the idea was that we would have no national church and the states could continue to have their establishments. And of course, these were abolished by the political process, the last one, I think, by 1820. But I also believe that the 14th Amendment incorporates the entire First Amendment. I think that was very conscious on the part of the framers of the 14th Amendment and requires the states to maintain democratic systems observing the guarantees of the Bill of Rights, one of which is establishment. And, I've heard this said, that what the Establishment Clause made, this is what David Barton says, this is Michelle Bachman, what the Establishment Clause means is that no one Christian denomination can be the official church. It's general Christianity that is, quote, the religion of America, and that phrase is used. And I think that is completely wrong. That is demonstrably wrong, not only in terms of how we live today in a pluralistic society, but in terms of what was going on at the time of the framing. And I think that if you look at the history of the thought that went into the framing of the religious clauses, this was a period when most enlightened people believed that what they called revealed religion, religion based on a holy book, released based on prophecy, based on miracle, that that was passing from the scene, that nobody really believed in that anymore. This was the age of deism. They had no clue about the kind of what we unselfconsciously call Christianity today, which didn't really come into existence until the Cane Creek Revival, which I think was in 1809, but it may have been 1819. And that is the rise of what we today would call evangelical, personalistic, conversion-minded, fundamentalist, biblically literalist Christianity. That didn't exist. They didn't see that as a force. They, I think, thought that all religious sects, whether Christian or non-Christian, would melt away. And we just wouldn't fight about it anymore. Well, you know, they were wrong about a lot of things. Secondly, there is a tremendous amount of discussion in the record in which they say, look, we know most people are Christian in this country, but this system has to be open to everybody. And they even say, you know, Mohammedans, infidels, you know, we must open the system to those people because we don't want to tell anybody who might come to this country that they're not welcome. There was a very powerful strain of thought at the framers that said, we're going to move the whole question of Christianity, of religion, everything over here, out of the national government's purview, and just say, we're open to everybody, and let the people decide.
Professor Epps next addressed the notion of equality and self-governance within the context of the First Amendment. It's an interesting discussion, and it brings into sharp relief the impact of Citizens United, where the Supreme Court held that restrictions on political speech were unconstitutional when based solely on the corporate identity of the speaker.
Well, you know, I think our First Amendment jurisprudence started to go off the rails, not with Citizens United, because there is a kind of narrative people say, which is, you know, we were going along, everything was fine, and then these guys came out from behind the curtain and said Citizens United, and now we live in hell. I think the road to hell is a lot more longer, and it starts with Buckley versus Valeo, when a majority of the court bought onto this principle that the First Amendment absolutely forbids government from ever trying to level the playing field in politics and public discourse. That government is absolutely debarred from trying to make sure that a multitude of voices is heard. That equality has nothing to do with the First Amendment. I'm having a lot of dialogue with people who want to organize a drive to amend the Constitution. There's a big, and they want to make it about corporate personhood. That is a loser, okay? Because corporate personhood is not the key to the Citizens United result. What Citizens United says is, we characterize this speech as important, and therefore the identity of the speaker is irrelevant. Not corporations are people, and therefore they have a right. Okay, and so I would like to see us focus on the necessity for an equal dialogue, and I would like to see us focus on, if necessary, a constitutional amendment to allow things that will allow that to take place. I was just yesterday having lots of things to do and not wanting to do any of them, I actually tried to draw up a constitutional amendment that would do what I would like it to do. And it said, nothing in this Constitution or the amendments thereto shall be construed to forbid Congress or any state from enacting a mandatory system of public financing in which candidates must participate, provided only that funds shall be adequate to run competitive elections. Contribution limits and disclosure requirements. You know, and I'm obviously playing with that wording. But I think we need to focus on what it is we want. Public financing is a great idea. I think people like it when it's explained to them. You mean no one can go to see their congressman with their checkbook in their hand? What a good idea. Equality is an important value in democracy. It is being systematically pushed off the stage of debate. We got to push back.
Now, expanding the 10th Amendment is at the center of the right wing's entire constitutional project. According to Professor Epps, this distorts and undermines the entire structure of the Constitution.
Well, the 10th Amendment that Mike Lee and Ted Cruz and people argue for is really Article 1 of the Articles of Confederation. Articles of Confederation said each state retains its sovereignty, independence, and right, except insofar as they're delegated to the Confederation. There's nothing in the Constitution that says states have any sovereignty against the federal government. As early as 1865, the most conservative figure in the North, President Andrew Johnson, said, "One thing this war has settled, we've settled the fact that there is no such thing as state sovereignty." That's the language of the Confederacy. And we are now reviving it with the idea that states can block environmental regulation, health inspections.
In Professor Epps' opinion, the 14th Amendment, with its guarantees of due process and equal protection, is the single most important amendment to our Constitution. Thus, he's very concerned about conservative efforts to recast the 14th Amendment solely as an effort to address the situation of the freed slaves. With slavery obviously now long abolished, it would follow that the amendment would today be a dead letter as a result.
When I used to live in the Northwest, and being a con law guy in the Northwest is great fun because the Minister of Justice of various militia will come and see you. And I got to know these guys, you know, and they're in many ways charming. They leave their guns outside. And they would say, very frankly, there are two kinds of citizens in this country. There are the sovereign citizens, which are white males, and the 14th Amendment citizens, which are everybody else. And that's fine. We accept that everybody else are citizens, you know, in their way. But sovereign citizens are the ones that who are the subjects of the Constitution. That idea in diluted form remains with this idea of the people, as the right expresses it.
Later, Professor Epps would take a question about affirmative action policies and how they fit within the aims of the 14th Amendment.
The idea that the Equal Protection Clause was going to be a limit on what the government could do in order to assist excluded groups making their way into the national mainstream has no historical warrant, none. And when you think about Justice Scalia's claims, it's important to note that the question of the original intent of the 14th Amendment made no appearance in the briefing and argumentation of Fisher. It is all done in terms of what we, the right, think is pragmatic going forward, and we'd really prefer that there be no power of government to use race in order to open opportunities for people. Originalism just drops right out when it doesn't support their side.
Next, Professor Epps addressed the rise in hostility to the 17th Amendment, which requires the popular election of senators.
This one is really Mashuka, as far as I'm concerned. You know, and I think it is a mask generally for a nostalgia for the, not for the Founders Republic, but for the Lochner Gilded Age. If we could just get the rich and the powerful and the state governments enshrined inside the federal government, and as Glenn Beck says, Obamacare would never have seen the light of day. It is worth studying just to give you a picture of how, and remember, Justice Scalia has signed on to this. He has said, if I could repeal one part of the Constitution, it would be the 17th Amendment. And it is an idea that the people, those idiots, cannot be trusted and must be restrained. So it's kind of a stalking horse for a whole complex of ideas about limiting the power of self-government.
International law was a personal interest of mine back in law school, and so I was fascinated to hear Professor Epps' take on why conservatives find international law to be such a threat to our constitutional order, and a threat that must be kept out of American courtrooms at all costs.
We hear a lot about American exceptionalism. We've heard in the last 4 years that Obama doesn't believe in it. But what they're really talking about is what I call American exemptionalism, meaning the rules don't apply to us. If we want to torture people, we're allowed to because we're America. We don't have to follow our treaty obligations and our obligation under the extradition treaty with Mexico because we are America and we are better than that. We don't have to observe international human rights norms. We are America. We are exempt. And this is a very dangerous idea. It's on a collision course with international reality. And one reason, for example, the military is very strong supporters of, in many ways, of humane treatment of prisoners is because they know that it's going to come a time when our prisoners are being held somewhere. And we need international law to protect our own interests. If we dismantle it, we're going to be very sorry.
During audience Q&A, Professor Epps was asked how progressives should message around privacy rights, including abortion rights, and he returned to his thesis of embracing equality and personal autonomy.
You know, there are certain terms that enter the constitutional debate and are kind of distracting, okay? Privacy is sort of, in some ways, another word like that, because it doesn't, you know what Inigo Montoya says in The Princess Bride, he says, you keep using that word, I don't think it means what you think of it. People can really attack the privacy argument much more broadly. I think the most interesting critique of Roe versus Wade was one made by then-Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg in an essay she wrote called Speaking in a Judicial Voice, where she basically said Roe had a correct result as far as the Texas statute went, but the argument should have been based, first of all, in a kind of autonomy, not privacy. You know, that if the state can lock you up for a felony, for having an abortion for any reason, then it's very difficult to say we live in a free system, because that was the Texas law. And secondly, in equality. And I keep coming back to equality. If the abortion rights and reproductive rights were based in the need for, you know, we heard Governor Romney say, yes, I'm all for women and I'm willing to let them go home early and cook dinner for their families, and that's what kind of, don't try to thank me, I'm just that kind of guy, right? If that is our vision, right, then we've already lost. Equality has to be have a somewhat more robust character than it has recently, and that goes for gender equality too.
He also touched on the importance of stare decisis, particularly when it comes to Roe v. Wade.
We do have to focus people's minds on the fact that for the court to run around overturning precedents that are, you know, Grutter is, 9 years old. Casey, it's not Roe now, it's Casey is the law. Casey is 20 years old. For the court to completely disregard stare decisis, completely disregard the reliance interests that society has in stability of our law is really quite radical. And I think that's a second thread of the argument that is more practical than going back and saying Roe should have been decided in different ways.
After a morning spent discussing the many positive progressive implications of the Constitution, one final question challenged Professor Epps to explain how the Electoral College made any sense.
I think that I've been writing about getting rid of the Electoral College now for more than 10 years, and I think it would be a really good thing to do. The electoral system was put in place for the worst possible reason, as far as I'm concerned, which was the slave states wanted representation for their slaves. They got that in the Three-Fifths Clause. But, you know, at the same time, if they just let people vote, they didn't let a whole lot of people vote. Right, they sure didn't call the slaves in together and say, guys, we've got representation for you. So 3/5 of you are going to go to the polls now and vote and make sure to be back in time, you know, for afternoon chores. So there would be a small number of voters coming out of the South. So instead of representing voters, we're going to allow them to represent states. It's a terrible system. It doesn't work. It goes off. You know, sometimes I think that America is like one of these Three Stooges routines. You know how sometimes there's a piano swinging back and forth on a rope and Curly doesn't see it, so he stands there and the piano knocks him down and he's like, what happened? He gets up and the piano knocks him down again. That's what happens to us in the Electoral College, over and over and over. 2000 came and went, and nobody says, gosh, if it weren't for the electoral votes, this wouldn't have mattered. We had a winner. And everybody says, oh, yeah, the Electoral College, what just hit me?